Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Christopher Bush, a professor of English at Hillsdale College. He joins us in the studio as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Chris, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Good to be here, John.
Why is The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck a great book?
Well, it's an American epic. It's a long novel. It's centered around a journey from Salisaw, Oklahoma, to the Central Valley of California, and really captures the great migration during the Dust Bowl of the 1930s.
We're going to talk about the characters, the story, what this says about Oklahoma and California and America. Also, who was John Steinbeck and what is his legacy as an American novelist? Chris, let's just jump right into how The Grapes of Wrath begins. Published in 1939, the first chapter is just a description of Oklahoma. There are really no characters to speak of in it. We get them soon after. It's all setting. And the first line of The Grapes of Wrath is this, quote, "To the red country and part of the gray country of Oklahoma, the last rains came gently and they did not cut the scarred earth," unquote. What is Steinbeck doing here?
Well, John, the first chapter, as you said, doesn't start the narrative, really. What it does is it tries to set the scene. But I think even more importantly, it's the first of a series of chapters that are known as the intercalary chapters. The intercalary chapters in The Grapes of Wrath step aside from the main narrative. And what they really do is they universalize the experience of the main characters of the Joads. And that's what that first chapter does, is it sets this tone and really, I think, ends up enabling the particular events to become much more universal and much more significant as he goes through all of these chapters.
We'll talk about the Joads in a second, but what is he telling us about Oklahoma then in this first chapter? What do we learn about that place?
Oklahoma is, first of all, it's kind of middle America. It's a place of farms. In the Oklahoma of the novel, there are still teams of horses and wagons. It's farm country. They're growing corn. And it's the Dust Bowl. It's the beginning of the Dust Bowl. And that's the setting that he chooses to establish there.
So what is the Dust Bowl? We should say, obviously, this is the 1930s. So the Great Depression is fully underway. It combines, I guess, with the Dust Bowl. You get a kind of hybrid vigor of awfulness for the people of Oklahoma right now. But what is the Dust Bowl?
So the Dust Bowl was a period of drought in the 1930s. It extended as far west, at least, as Colorado, New Mexico, and then east into the plains. The Dust Bowl was in part the result of nature, but it was also in part the result of trying to transport the Jeffersonian agrarian dream or vision from the East Coast out onto the arid plains. The farmers plowed and plowed and plowed until the soil became depleted and then ended up just blowing away.
Every farmer knows that drought is an occupational hazard. You're going to have good years and bad years in terms of the weather.
Yes.
But part of the tragedy of the Dust Bowl is that it involves bad farming techniques.
Yes.
They compounded the problem.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And it was always, I think, somewhat marginal because there just wasn't as much rain west of the Mississippi as there is east of the Mississippi. And so this was a particularly dry period.
So it's a bad time in Oklahoma.
It is.
And now let's meet Tom Joad, our main character. He's one of the great characters in American literature. Who is he? How do we meet him in The Grapes of Wrath?
Tom Joad is eldest son in the Joad family. He has a bit of a past. He is just being released from prison. He was serving a sentence for having killed a man in kind of just an unfortunate fit of passion, and he really didn't want to kill the man and didn't really have any great animosity to him. So he is he's just been released from prison. He's walking home, and he has no idea that his family is packing up and getting ready to go to California.
And why are they doing that?
Basically, what's happened to the Joads, and Steinbeck does a beautiful job of describing this, is that, you know, a generation or two before, they homesteaded the land and broke the land and settled. And then eventually what happened is that they ran short of money, they mortgaged the land, and then eventually they ended up, in a sense, losing the land and becoming sharecroppers on the land. And what's happening as the novel opens is that there's a transition that's occurring from the kind of small family farm to more of a corporate farming model. So as the Joads are leaving their farm and going to California, tractors are coming in, and they're basically consolidating the individual farms into much larger corporate farmed land.
The matriarch of the family is Ma Joad. There's a bunch of Joads. We could talk about a lot of characters here, but Ma Joad is important. This is the mother of Tom Joad. Who is she?
Ma Joad, throughout the novel, holds the family together. And family is her, I think, in many ways, her greatest value. And she's very concerned that Tom won't know where they are if he comes out and they've already left. And so she's very, very happy that he has come home and that he'll be able to go with them. There's some complication because he's not allowed to leave the state based on his parole status, but he ends up going with them anyway. So she holds the family together.
And so they're packing up and going to California, which is a great American story in a lot of ways. And the next part of the book is about their migration. They go from Oklahoma to California. So who goes?
Eventually, the whole family goes. Grandpa decides at the very last minute that he won't go, and they end up having to, get him a little bit inebriated and finally get him to go. But he dies along the way, and Grandma dies along the way.
So about a dozen members of the family, this group, head out for California. They're headed to the promised land, or at least they think so.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, California is the promised land, and that language is clearly biblical. They're accompanied by a preacher named Jim Casey, who has lost his calling, and he said he's no longer going to be preaching or telling the people, leading the people. He's going to be listening. So he's just going to listen and to follow the people. His initials, Jim Casey or JC, some see an analog in him to Jesus Christ. But in any event, he is going with the people and becomes a very, very important figure as the novel unfolds.
There are a lot of biblical connections with The Grapes of Wrath. Jim Casey and his initials, that's one of them. Also, this exodus to a kind of promised land in California. Yes. There are so many others, but it's also in the very title of the novel, The Grapes of Wrath. So maybe you can explain that for us. I'm thinking, you know, Steinbeck could have done a series of books, you know, The Apples of Vengeance, the bananas of Jealousy.
Yes.
But Grapes of Wrath actually means something.
Yes, yes. And the original title for the book was L'Affaire Lettuceburg.
good thing he changed that. The marketing genius who suggested that did his job that day.
And actually, it was his wife, Carol, who basically told him that what he had been writing was not worthy. And so he started over again, and she suggested the title, The Grapes of Wrath. The Grapes of Wrath comes, in the Bible, it comes from the book of Revelation, where an angel has gone down to earth, is gathering the grapes, and they're going, it's really a vision of God's anger with human beings. And so that's where it first appears. And then, of course, in the Battle Hymn of the Republic, that phrase is also used.
So he's invoking the Bible. He's invoking one of the great patriotic songs in American history, a war song, by the way, with the title. We're going to learn a lot more about the story as it unfolds, as they reach California and what they find and don't find there. But The Grapes of Wrath, is this a wrathful book? Is this an angry book?
Well, I think it is. It is an angry book. It's really, I think, a book about betrayal. It's really the betrayal of the promise of America, going all the way back to, you know, to Thomas Jefferson, and that dream of the small farm, the independent farmer, the free person. And I think that's really the heart of Steinbeck's vision in so many ways, is that the Jodes are really meant to represent the common man in America. And there's a wonderful scene in one of these intercalary chapters where he talks about how they the migrants are all traveling more or less singly in their own cars. But then at night, they'll stop by the roadside and they'll ask, someone will stop, and then another car will come and they'll stop and say, you know, may we join you? And they will. And then they'll all gather around the campfire, and they'll tell stories. And stories they'll tell will be the stories really of America. One will talk about fighting Geronimo, and another will, you know, talk about grandfather homesteading the land and that kind of thing. And there's a sense that somehow these people who had believed so deeply and lived out so deeply the American dream were now somehow displaced, and they were on the road, and they were going to the promised land, as you said, to California, but it doesn't turn out to be the promised land that they had hoped it would be.
So what do they find in California?
Well, I think one of the lines that Steinbeck writes that's so powerful is in one of the intercalary chapters, a figure, not one of the characters, but a figure says, California's owned, which means that basically it's not possible to homestead in California. It's not possible to get a little farm, which is what they really had hoped for. To some extent, what he portrays is kind of agribusiness, more or less. These are very, very large farms, and the Jodes end up being farm workers who are picking the crops. They don't plant, they pick, and then they need to move on.
They don't own their own land. They don't set up a family farm. And they wind up in a migrant camp.
They do, yes. The migrant camp, the government camp, where they get to spend a little bit of time, is actually presented by Steinbeck as a kind of model. It's based on a camp that was run by a man named Tom Collins. Actually, the book is dedicated to Tom in part, and that is not Tom Jode, but it's Tom Collins, who ran the government migrant camp, and it's, you know, they have running water, and they're safe from any kind of, you know, vigilante raids or things like that. It's quite different than what were known as the Hoovervilles, which were the kind of just ad hoc camps that were set up down by the river and were often, as Steinbeck describes it, you know, raided or burned out or by some of the local people.
This idealized camp, if that's what it is, a kind, yes, of idealized, I don't want to say utopian, but you know, it's the nicest place they're finding in California.
Yes.
It's called Weed Patch.
Yes.
That's a strange,
yes,
name.
Yes, yes. I think that's actually a town in California, I think in Central Valley, as you drive through all the little towns there. And it's a place where really a community is able to form. So I believe there's a welcoming committee of women who come to welcome the Joads. They have dances on, you know, on the weekends, and it's a place where they feel safe and where they feel respected. I think that's one of the key elements, because I think there's a lot in the novel about, you know, that they're Americans and this is their home. They belong here, and they feel very much that they're not respected and that they're just, you know, kind of being moved along all the time. So the reason they couldn't stay in at that camp was because there was no work. Once everything is picked, there was no more work, and they needed to work in order to survive.
Tom starts to work in a peach orchard, and he gets involved in labor activism.
Yes. And Jim Casey is also involved in that. And what they're really trying to do is they're trying to empower the workers so that they'll be able to get a living wage. The story that Steinbeck tells is that the growers in California had published flyers, sent them back to Oklahoma and other places saying there was work in California. And there was work in California. The problem was that too many people responded to the advertisements. And so, of course, that depressed wages. Often, what Steinbeck depicts in the novel is that the characters are basically only making enough in order to buy their food for the day. And then they have to work the next day in order to do that. So it becomes a very, very precarious way of life.
Jim, as you say, becomes a labor organizer. Tom leads a strike. They want better wages and working conditions.
Yes, that's right. And I think, again, they want to have their human dignity. In California, as it's depicted, the group is called the Associated Farmers, and it's just very, very highly organized. I think if we look at the situation objectively, as much as we can, I think Steinbeck is clearly on the side of the workers, you know, as I think we also, you know, feel that through his lens. But for the people who lived in California at the time, the landowners and just the people in the community, it must have been frightening to see really, you know, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of people who were coming with really nothing and no work. And they were, in many cases, during some of the winters, ironically, California experienced really intense rainfall, while during the Dust Bowl in the rest of the country, there was all this rain. And Steinbeck, in his letters, writes about the danger, you know, people starving to death. So I think it must have been a very, very unsettled situation. And as more and more people came and there was less work for them, undoubtedly, you know, things became a little bit frightening for a lot of the people there.
You mentioned Steinbeck observed a lot of this. Steinbeck was a California writer. It's where he's born.
Yes.
He lived in California. He actually witnessed a lot of the conditions that he then wrote about in The Grapes of Wrath. And he performed journalism even. He went out and looked at these conditions, wrote about them for a San Francisco newspaper. Part of me, Chris, wants to say this book starts with journalism.
And it absolutely does, yes. He published a series of articles that became The Harvest Gypsies. So it really was as much of our great realist fiction, you know, has roots in journalism. Some people, you know, had thought that he had actually traveled across the country with the people from Oklahoma who became known as Okies, which was kind of a derogatory term, but he didn't actually do that. But he did travel with Tom Collins and in the Central Valley. And so he did actually see the migrant camps there. He also, Tom Collins also linked him up with the photographer Dorothea Lange, whose images of the Great Depression are so much tied in our imagination to that time.
This term Okie is interesting because in the book, when the Joads start to encounter it, it's a put down, it's a pejorative. When I first heard the term I think it was probably from the Merle Haggard song, Okie from Muskogee.
Yes.
Which is from 1969. So this is 30 years after the novel. And that song is a kind of counter-countercultural song.
Yes.
And it really, really owns the term to the point where I'm not sure Okie is a put-down anymore.
Yes. Yes. He's proud to be an Okie from Muskogee, I think. But at that time it was, and they didn't, the characters, as it's told in the novel, they didn't know what people were talking about. Why are they calling us that? Now, that was an entirely new experience for them.
So you've got a bunch of Okies in California, the Joad family. There's the social unrest. There are just too many people for the number of jobs available. You have a situation where the farmers there aren't really quite built for this massive infusion,
right,
of labor, and it leads to violence.
It does, yes. Jim Casey is killed. He's portrayed as kind of a martyr to the cause. Tom is severely beaten and injured, and then kind of hunted by the authorities, and he has to go into hiding. So, Steinbeck was very interested in labor issues, especially in agriculture, in The Grapes of Wrath, and then in an earlier novel, In Dubious Battle, he also also deals with a strike in an orchard. And so, he's very interested in depicting the conditions of 20th century agriculture. And I think in contrast to the idea of the self-sufficient farm, the homestead that was celebrated in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Now, we got to talk about another character, and that's Rose of Sharon. She's
yes.
the sister of Tom,
yes.
a much younger sister. She's pregnant
yes.
at the start of the novel. What happens to her?
Rose of Sharon is married to a man named Connie. They're traveling with the family. Rose of Sharon is, of course, very concerned for the child that's growing within her. And one of the tensions, I think, that we have in the novel is that there just isn't enough food even for her, you know. And she says, I really need to have milk. I really need to have, you know, meat. So there is that. Unfortunately, what happens to the family as they move across the country and as things begin to kind of degenerate in California is that members of the family tend to kind of go away and kind of peel off from, and Ma is trying desperately to hold them all together, but Connie is one who goes away. And so Rose of Sharon is left by herself with her baby, the birth pending.
A lot of this novel is an old-fashioned family saga as the Joads go from Oklahoma to California, and they suffer from attrition along the way. The grandparents die, as you mentioned, then you have the abandonment of Connie, and this family group just becomes reduced, and it's ultimately kind of story of survival.
Yes, yes, it is. And for Ma, the family is everything. Keep the family together. That is her main main goal. And one thing that's really interesting in that regard is the role that that men, that fathers and husbands traditionally played back in Oklahoma. And they are seen as the leaders of the family. And they're it's said in that first chapter, I believe, that the women and the children looking at the men, if the men are all right, then things will be all right. But what happens is, as they no longer have land, no longer have the farms to run, the men tend to fade into the background a bit. And Ma really rises, I think, into the leadership position in the family.
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Tom is one of the great characters in American literature. He's maybe not quite at the Huck Finn level or Tom Sawyer level of brand name familiarity, but he's up there with them, I think. What makes him such a compelling figure in this story?
Well, I think part of the reason is that we know him well because he's in a lot of chapters. He is a kind of a leadership figure among the family too. But I think one thing that's really important is that Steinbeck creates in Tom a kind of mythic figure. I mean, very deliberately, toward the end of the novel, when Tom has gone into hiding because he has this bruise on his face, on his head, that would identify him as one that the authorities are hunting. And Ma says, well, what's going to happen to you, Tom? And Steinbeck writes this. He says, Tom is speaking, and he says, then I'll be all around in the dark. I'll be everywhere, wherever you look. Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. If Casey knowed, that's Jim Casey, if Casey knowed, why, I'll be in the way guys yell when they're mad. And I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready. And when our folks eat the stuff they raise and live in the houses they build, while I'll be there. And so I think that the vision really that Steinbeck had of Tom, not just as a character, but also as, in a sense, kind of the embodiment of the American, the American dream, and that there was a sense that that would go on, and that the voice of the people and the dignity of the people would be restored. And so I think there is some hope for that, at least.
That passage comes near the end of the novel. And I want to ask about the very end of the novel because it's peculiar. At least it was to me. Rose no longer has her husband, not right. around anyway, but she has her baby and the baby's stillborn. It's yes. dead.
Yes.
But what happens then at the very end?
What's happened is that the Jodes have taken refuge in some railroad boxcars. And it's raining, it's flooding, and the boxcars are basically being overrun by the water. And so they end up taking refuge in a barn. In the barn, they find a man who is basically starving to death. So Rose of Sharon has lost her baby, as you said, and she has milk that was intended for the baby. And so there's some communication between Rose of Sharon and Ma Jode. And Rose of Sharon basically agrees to allow the starving man to take the place of her baby at her breast. And the way that the novel ends is that it says, Rose of Sharon smiled mysteriously.
Yeah, that's the passage. This is the very final three sentences of the novel. Quote, her hand moved behind his head and supported it. Her fingers moved gently in his hair. She looked up and across the barn, and her lips came together and smiled mysteriously. Unquote. That's the end. There's like this Mona Lisa smile.
Yes.
At the end. Chris, explain that. What's going on here?
It's really an amazing image, and I think it's a refashioning of a famous religious sculptural image. It's basically Steinbeck's refashioning of a Pietà, the famous sculptures where Mary is holding the body of Jesus. The difference is that the starving man is not dead. He is actually alive, and he's being sustained, in a sense, by Rose of Sharon's offering, by her, not exactly sacrifice, but offering. I think that's where Steinbeck, I think, is finally going in that hopefulness in the novel, is that, and he puts this into Ma's speeches earlier. He says, they will keep on. The people, the spirit of the people will keep on. And I think that last scene is really very much in line with that. It's a scene of the people caring for themselves, caring for one another, and quite hopeful.
John Steinbeck is one of the great American novelists, born 1902, died 1968. The Grapes of Wrath, 1939, probably his most famous novel. Also wrote, before Grapes of Wrath, wrote Of Mice and Men, a very popular book in high schools to assign,
yes.
It's nice and short.
Yes.
It's also a good book. Later wrote East of Eden, that's 1952. So many other books. Chris, what is the John Steinbeck legacy? What does he mean to American literature?
Well, I do think that John Steinbeck is a permanent part of American literature. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He's a Nobel Prize winner. Unfortunately, there were some who didn't think he ought to have received the Nobel Prize and went into print saying that. I think what Steinbeck still very much speaks to the American dream, to the American people, and to their vision, I think, of what America has always been, and hopefully, still will be. It's a place where the individual is important, where human dignity is important, and he speaks to that. The other thing is, I think he's an extraordinary storyteller, and he also the settings, as you mentioned in the first chapter of The Grapes of Wrath, the settings, especially around Salinas, south of San Francisco, Cannery Row in Monterey, he brings it to life, and he brings the settings, the characters are you feel as if you're there.
I'm not going to ask you if The Grapes of Wrath is the great American novel. We don't need to play that parlor game. But is it the great California novel?
Well, that's a really good question. I suppose California doesn't come off very well in the novel, unfortunately. So I don't know if it's a celebration of California. It is the California dream, going west and finding the oranges hanging from the trees. And so, but as far as it's a great epic American novel, because it captures that whole westward movement so well, and takes it from basically its roots in the 18th and 19th century and brings it to the 20th century. And I think that's a lot of its power, I think, comes from that decisions that Steinbeck made.
How did you discover The Grapes of Wrath? What's your story as a reader? Yeah,
it was assigned in high school, in junior year in high school in American literature. And that's when I really developed my great love for American literature. It was in that class that I read The Grapes of Wrath for the first time, Of Mice and Men, and another novel that your listeners might enjoy, especially by Willa Cather, and it's called My Antonia, and another one that she wrote called O Pioneers, which are set in frontier settings. My Antonia is really a powerful epic portrayal of the settling of the West. So that's where I first really encountered Steinbeck.
Longtime listeners will know that we've done several episodes on Willa Cather, so you can go back in the archives and check out those. Chris, one more final question. What is the case for reading The Grapes of Wrath now? So much of it is rooted in its time, in its places. Is there a reason to read it now in the 2020s?
Well, I think so. I think any great works benefit from multiple readings. I think one thing I would say is that to call it, as some do, a protest novel is really probably to limit its scope and its impact. It's a novel about the American experience. And I think to understand the American experience, I think we have to come to terms with the frontier, and we have to come to terms with our history, because we still, in so many ways, have that within us and within our stories, within our the ways that we look at the world and at our experience. So I think it's a great story. He's a great storyteller. I think it's really worth revisiting.
Christopher Bush, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com on Twitter. My handle is at heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. Exco, give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Biosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Exco, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.